Hello and welcome to this British Journal of Surgery podcast. I'm Wendy Barnaby and this podcast is the second one about bariatric surgery. Today we're discussing whether it's an acceptable treatment for obesity. We heard in the first podcast how obesity is on the rise. Bariatric procedures in the UK and the United States have been increasing dramatically year on year. But two important questions arise: the cost implications, especially in a time of cuts, and the main complications that occur after the surgery itself. Today we're discussing two BJS papers that deal with these questions. First, the cost. The Finnish Office of Health Technology Assessment has produced a paper called Cost Utility of Bariatric Surgery for Morbid Obesity in Finland. And we're joined by one of its authors, Ms. Suvi Macklin, from the National Institute of Health and Welfare in Helsinki. Suvi, why did you and your colleagues undertake this study?
Well, like you already said about the UK, that the number of bariatric procedures has increased enormously. Well, the same goes for Finland also. For example, in 2006, there were only 99 bariatric surgeries done in Finland. And just 4 years later, last year, the figure was almost 8 times larger. Basically, there was this increasing demand, and it was affecting each of the hospital districts. Also, at the same time, the people at the social insurance institution were trying to decide whether to reimburse bariatric surgery or not.
Right. So you studied patients with a body mass index of 40 or 35 if they had other obesity-related conditions. Can you tell me very briefly what that involved and what were your main findings?
We basically compared the bariatric surgery with so-called ordinary treatment for obesity. So we constructed a model that in the bariatric surgery part of the model, we included 3 different surgical techniques. In the model, we tried to capture this current practice of treating obesity and all of the variation in it, and decided to use national representative data on adult population, which made it possible to explain healthcare resource use by AIDS, also sex and BMI and comorbidities such as sleep apnea and type 2 diabetes. The main finding of the study was simple enough, as based on the base case analysis, bariatric surgery was both more effective and less costly than ordinary treatment. There was only one exception worth mentioning, gastric banding, which dominated ordinary treatment only if the baseline body mass index was set to 42 or higher.
So apart from banding, the surgery paid for itself after 5 years. Is it reasonable to say that?
Yeah, you could say that.
Recent papers in the BJS have shown that obesity is a huge problem in many Western societies. What do you think the implications for your study are for Finland and other Western societies as well?
Well, at least in Finland, our study results have been used when deciding on the allocation of healthcare resources to this intervention. This study results, these are very similar to other previously published studies, and I would like to say that they strengthen the conclusion that surgery is cost-effective.
So it sounds as though surgery is a very important tool in the anti-obesity kit then. And thank you, Suvi, very much indeed for joining us. We've seen over these two podcasts that bariatric surgery is an effective treatment for obesity. But, of course, as the number of procedures rises, there will inevitably be complications. And that's what our second paper deals with. This one's called Management of Late Postoperative Complications of Bariatric Surgery. And we're joined by one of its authors, Mr. Khalid Hamdan, consultant upper GI and bariatric surgeon of Brighton and Sussex University Hospitals in the UK. Khalid, your paper's a review of late complications after bariatric surgery and the best way of managing them. But before we get on to that, could you just say a word about the early complications after these procedures?
Well, before I answer your question, I would like to point out that one of the reasons why bariatric surgery has become an attractive option for the treatment of obesity and its related comorbidities is that it's evolved to become a relatively safe option with a low complication profile. For example, we know that gastric banding is probably safer than laparoscopic cholecystectomy, and Roux-en-Y gastric bypass is as safe as total hip replacement. Having said that, we still see complications in the immediate post-operative period, particularly in patients who are undergoing Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. One of the complications we look for in these patients is anastomotic leak, which is seen in less than 1 to 2% of the cases. Other complications include pulmonary embolism, deep vein thrombosis, and cardiorespiratory complications.
And so to the late complications, Khalid, I mean, what are the three most common late complications, do you think, following restrictive and restrictive with malabsorption procedures?
Well, different procedures have a different complication profile. For example, the most common complication we see after gastric banding is band slippage, which occurs in up to 15 to 20% of patients. Late complications after gastric bypass include intestinal obstruction from adhesions, internal hernia or anastomotic stricture. We also have nutritional deficiencies and functional GI disturbances such as dumping syndrome, which are relatively common, particularly in patients who fail to comply with the dietary advice we give after such procedures. Another complication to be aware of is gallstone disease, and up to one-third of patients develop gallstones after bariatric surgery. But it's important to realize that only 10% of these patients become symptomatic and therefore require surgical intervention.
So there's quite a list of complex problems that can follow this surgery. Do you think that they should be dealt with by the acute general surgeon or in a specialist center?
Well, this is a very important question. Well, generally speaking, early complications are usually dealt with in the bariatric unit where the procedure was carried out. However, because of the reduced hospital stay, which nowadays averages about 2 to 3 days for a gastric bypass, some patients may still present to the general surgeon with acute problems. But what's becoming increasingly more common is patients being admitted on a general surgical take with late complications, and this is the focus of our article. Our paper attempts to, if you like, demystify some of the issues about the management of these patients by outlining certain important principles. These include the importance of understanding the anatomical changes after bariatric surgery, particularly after Roux-en-Y gastric bypass. When in doubt about the nature of the problem, my advice to the general surgeon is to seek advice or refer these patients to a bariatric unit.
Thank you, Khalid, very much indeed. We're now joined by BJS editor Professor Kees de Jong of the Maastricht University Medical Center in Belgium. Case, in this podcast and the previous one, we've heard a lot of evidence from the pages of the BJS about bariatric surgery. Given the difficult economic climate at the moment, the numbers of bariatric procedures are likely to fall, even though the demand is rising. What do you think about that?
If one would put constraints on the number of procedures that could be performed in each and every country, that would be rather short-sighted, because it has been proven by these studies and also similar studies in the UK that bariatric surgery is highly cost-effective and will save money for society in the future, particularly after 5 years. So really, I do think that there should be no constraints on bariatric surgery if one wants to treat the symptoms that are caused by this disease. On the other hand, if you would take it from a more preventive aspect, one would say that it would be wise to try and maybe alter people's eating and drinking habits, because that may prevent people from becoming morbidly obese.
So if the numbers of procedures are restricted, which criteria do you think should be used to decide which groups of patients should be offered bariatric procedures?
Well, I think if one would have to use some criteria to select patients, it would be those patients who are severely obese, so those with a body mass index of over 50, or those who have comorbidity with a lower body mass index, and that would start, say, from 35 onwards, because it has been shown that these people are at particular risk of dying from, for example, cardiac events and from complications of diabetes.
What do you think, Kees, are the main conclusions from these two podcasts?
I think the main conclusions should be that bariatric surgery is cost-effective, and there should not be too much constraints on the number of procedures that are conducted in each and every country. And equally, as we are moving into a pandemic of more and more morbidly obese people entering the healthcare system, it is wise to realize that there will probably be more and more complications from this type of surgery, and they will also be seen at general surgical hospitals where no prior experience with bariatric surgery exists. finally, we are not yet fully aware, probably, of long-term complications that could ensue from redirecting the gastrointestinal flow of enteric contents. We do not yet know what the effects will be of letting the bile enter distally into the gastrointestinal tract. So we may, in the distant future, foresee that there will be complications that we cannot yet think of.
So a lot of work still to be done. Well, thank you, Case, very much indeed for that summary. And thanks again to Suvi Macklin and Khalid Hamdan, as well as to our speakers in the previous podcast, Jonathan Cowley, Magdalena Östlund and Richard Musk. And that's all from this BJS podcast. We hope you'll join us again.